where the particular financial asset with symmetric prepayment option meets the solely payment of principal and interest or SPPI condition in IFRS 9. And most committee members concluded that it does not meet the SPPI condition. At this discussion in December 2016, the board asked the staff to explore the potential ways forward, and this paper has our proposal together with summary of feedback and an indicative project timeline. When developing the proposal, we have tried to ensure that any solution considered is in line with the overall objective of the classification and measurement requirements of IFRS 9, which is to provide relevant and useful information in predicting the likely actual cash flows of financial instruments. The requirement to assess business model in addition to the SPPI condition remains unchanged. This paper discusses only the SPPI condition. As demonstrated in paragraph 15 to 22 of the paper, the mechanics of the amortized cost measurement would work if the symmetric prepayment option does not introduce any contractual cash flows amount different to what is considered SPPI in applying the existing requirements in paragraph B4111B. However, the staff do not think the negative compensation that could arise from symmetric prepayment option is consistent with the notion of basic lending arrangement, which underpins the SPPI condition. And the proposed amendment would be an exception. On the whole, we recommend the board consider providing a narrow scope exception as described in paragraph 21 of the paper. Also, we think the board should consider an additional eligibility condition to limit the scope of the proposed amendment to cases where the fair value of the symmetric prepayment option is insignificant at initial recognition. We think this would be a straightforward way to ensure that financial assets are not measured in amortized costs if it is likely that non-SPPI cash flows will occur, in which case the amortized cost measurement will not provide relevant and useful information. In terms of the effective date and transition, we propose aligning the effective date of the amendment with that of IFRS 9, 1st January 2018, and we recommend that it is applied retrospectively with a transition provision similarly to existing requirements. Lastly, we have the indicative project timeline in paragraph 31 and 33 of the paper. It is a tight timeline for all parties involved and is based on the assumption of a 30-day comment period. We are not asking the board to make a decision at this meeting about the comment period. We will do so at the February meeting once we have discussed the same with the due process committee. With this, we would like to turn it over to the board for its discussion.
Sue.
Thank you. I agree that we should propose to do something to address this issue. And I think I agree overall with the staff's recommendations for how we do that. They had a couple of observations that maybe are relevant for the basis or... in the paper we talk about the fact that the mechanics work even if we go in both directions for this prepayment option, and I certainly agree with that. I think what we need to be a little bit careful about is overdoing the comments about the usefulness of amortized cost information that arises in these circumstances. The reason why is that I think we very carefully chose when amortized cost and fair value through OCI, which gives amortized cost and P&L, is appropriate accounting in IFRS 9, and that was for circumstances where the business model was hold to collect, or where part of the business model was at least hold to collect, and where the cash flows were simple. I think the challenge we have as soon as we start having prepayments that have these sort of adjustments in it is that we have situations where we sort of merrily have an instrument which is booking interest at a nice level amount, and then all of a sudden, because of a prepayment, there's a spike up or down. And that starts to tend us towards sort of profit and loss figures and P&L that are along on the spectrum toward fair value type gains and losses, which we specifically don't like in P&L, which is why we have the whole business model test that we do. So We already have some of that, obviously, because we already allow some prepayments and we allow them sort of unders and overs depending on who's asked for the prepayment. And so we're only sort of extending what we've already got, so I accept that. But I think we still need to be cautious about how much we extend it because of these spikes, which wasn't really the idea for stuff that's got amortized cost in P&L.
Okay.
So I think one way of controlling that is by having the condition that you've proposed around the fair value of the derivative and the prepayment derivative in there. But that only goes so far, because if you have a prepayment even at fair value, the value of that derivative would be zero, and we don't want prepayments at fair value. So I think the thing that we need to do, which isn't a change to the standard, but which I think would help us in terms of making sure that the sort of spikes that occur are sort of within the reason, you know, that's logical for the model and that we can accept as useful information, would be to emphasise the fact that before you even get to this fair value test, you've got to make sure that you've got reasonable additional compensation for early termination. And I think some people are just reading the reasonable additional compensation and sort of saying, is it a big number or a small number? But it's really the for early termination that matters. And I think the point that I would sort of like to make, if we could somewhere, would be that if you thought that you had a term fixed rate instrument and somebody prepays you early, it's reasonable to be compensated for changes in rates, because you thought you had a long term fixed rate exposure and all of a sudden that's gone away, and that make-whole adjustment for interest rates is sort of keeping you whole for that interest rate exposure. That's fine. But at the other end of the spectrum, reasonable additional compensation that wouldn't be okay would be compensation that, for example, would compensate you for all fair value changes, because you were meant to be in a business model with simple cash flows where you had an interest rate exposure. Fair value exposure was not one of the things that you were exposed to. And that would be sort of belt and braces in terms of the types of reasonable additional compensation we think is okay in addition to this fair value trigger. But if we emphasise that, then I think I can live with the additional scope, and I think it's a fair response to some of the questions that have been raised.
Can I just make... absolutely agree. So we tried to do that a little bit in paragraph 22 of the paper, where we have seen what was coming in and what are the other elements were breakage costs and everything. I would argue that's already there in paragraph B4.11b, but yes, we will emphasize
it is there, but I think it becomes more important. And yes, your paragraph 22 I think is helpful, but I think also tying it in with this notion that you had a business model with a long-term trade exposure just helps build on the whole logic in 9 and ties it all together a little bit more neatly.
Yeah. I agree with Sue's addition, because that will ensure that it will not get out of hand again.
Absolutely.
Gary.
Thank you. It, by the way, a well-written staff paper. And I do agree that proposed solution, it is certainly mechanically can be done. I do agree that the interpretations committee said this is beyond their scope, it should come to the board, and I also agree that we have to support IFRS 9. But with all that said, I got some concerns with the entire larger subject matter. And you know, to me, you know, specific words used count, and we say reasonable additional compensation. Since the proposal is kind of, doesn't matter which way the sign goes, in some cases this is a penalty, or it's a cost, or, you know, that doesn't feel like compensation. So I think this is more than just, well, let's just make sure we got symmetry, or it's a change. And I'm not so sure that's a great change, you know, because you think about it, the adjustment could be small, it could be big, it could vary over time. So when you've got the at least the theoretical capability of a big adjustment, you know, kind of fair value might seem like a better answer, you know, to my way of thinking. And I wasn't around for the votes on this particular one, so not 100% closed-minded or haven't made up my mind, but I mean, these are the issues I see with the coming. And I do agree that you can probably draft something very tightly. And we could, if we finish that way, you could probably write a final standard very tightly. But the problem is, the minute you put an exposure draft out, you don't know what's coming back in. And so you raise the question, is this the one you want to put the first exposure draft out? You know, when you're within months of the effective, you know, mandatory effective date of the standard by the time you're done, and what are we going to do with, I'll call it a large number of other narrow issues, but of relatively equal import, you know, to the people raised and come in. So I had issues on the timing of this one. I mean, IFR-STEIN is almost 3 years old now in terms of when it was published, and this now just comes in. So I asked for the staff's reaction, you know, broadly, but you can see I've got any number of doubts about the wisdom of proceeding. Again, back to words count. Compensation means a gain. It doesn't mean a penalty.
Do you want me to respond? Absolutely, Gary, couldn't agree more. I would say if there's the risk, biggest risk I see in the project is that we open up and other things come in. Mm-hmm. And I have thought about it, and I don't think there's a perfect answer to it. In my mind, when I was thinking about it, at least personally, I don't think I can ever go back and predict what the board would have done if it had come to them then. But I think in my mind, when I think about it, is that what I think it would be fair for me to posit is that certainly if the board had known this issue, we would have had a similar discussion around this, because given the size and the nature of the issue. I think the due process in my mind also helps us, because we didn't bring this project directly. We first come to you and ask you whether you think this should be something that should be added to the agenda. There will be a degree of judgment required in this, and I think this is a critical filter that you emphasize. I think that's the best answer I can give you, but this is certainly something we need to be cognizant about, that this doesn't mean that everything starts opening up.
Yeah, no, I understand, but many of the comment letters we get in exposure drafts, there's, oh, we answered your questions, well, by the way, what about all these other things? And you know, some good points might very well come through that seem as needed and timely, you know, yes, as perhaps this one is. So that's a larger concern than necessarily just the extant issue here, you know, on the table. And I wasn't here, you know, a lot of people at the table weren't here in these votes. You don't know what you'd have done if you focused on it. But, you know, considering the depth of the editing and the review process of the standards, and it didn't come up, you know, either this is the answer people wanted, or maybe it was oversight. I don't know. But the words still count.
No, don't disagree. But again, as I was saying, absolutely agree that is a risk. We have to also balance it with the board's also stated objective that we will be responsive and support implementation. So this will be the board will need to make.
Yeah, so I'm just challenging, is this really the one you want to lead with, you know?
Doug?
Thank you. Just a similar concern with Gary, and we are going to change the standard at this late stage. So therefore, we have to be very crystal clear to the outside world. Why do we do that now? And if we didn't do that, and if we keep the standard as it is, then it would cause a significant consequence. If that is the case, maybe it would be justified to do something now. So in order to do it, we have to prove that.
Right.
If we didn't do that, it would cause significant consequences. So then the question we need to ask seriously is, first question is, what is wrong with fair value through profit loss with this asset or this type of financial instrument? What is wrong with fair value through profit loss? That is the very important question we have to ask ourselves. And the second question we need to ask is there any difference between asset A type in your paper and asset B type financial instrument? If asset A type financial instrument and B type financial instrument is substantially same, then it would be reasonable to say that if we missed out, we simply missed out so we have to recover it in timely manner. That makes sense. So, but question is, if asset A and B is different, and the difference is reasonable to make a different accounting treatment, then there isn't any reason for us to make amendment now.
Yeah.
So then my question is the difference between asset A and B. And the asset A itself is asymmetric. So then if the borrower, if you are lender, bank, if the borrower triggers the prepayment, and then the borrower is in a position to pay the compensation, you can receive compensation. But if the situation is the case that the lender has to pay the compensation, you don't have to pay. But in the symmetric situation, even if the borrower triggered the prepayment, the lender has to pay it. And sometimes it will be the compensation amount, prepayment amount, could be lower than the carrying amount.
Yes.
And then in that case, the lender has to recognize losses, even if you didn't trigger the event, even if the borrower triggered the event. So we don't know when the borrower is going to trigger the event. So therefore, I think there is a significant difference between asset A and asset B. So therefore, in this sense, that what we made the decision about this exception makes some sense. So now I'm not 100% persuaded why we have to change such kind of notion. And what is, I don't understand what is wrong with keep measuring it, the fair value through profit or loss. And we need to answer to that question. Otherwise, you know, it's quite dangerous to go ahead.
Daryl? So maybe a couple of things from my side. I think firstly, to answer one of your questions, I think there is a significant consequence of leaving the words as they are. I think it has a very, very big impact. The second point that might be important for me is that I do agree there is an economic difference in that an entity can have an unexpected loss as a consequence instrument B, which they couldn't have as a consequence of instrument A. But I think on the other side of the equation, I think an entity could have an unexpected profit in the instrument A that they wouldn't have in instrument B. And I think actually those are two sides of the same coin. And I think some of the examples that illustrate that are saying exactly that. There's no reason to, I think that we would think differently about a profit or loss in an unexpected realm. The EIR calc does sort out some of that, but I think that would be an important part for me. So I think significant consequence, I think it is something that I might not have anticipated when I was thinking about the standard originally. So for that, from that perspective, I think it is worth thinking about this issue. The other thing that I thought was really important for me, but there's a caveat to that, is that it's an issue with significant consequence. It's an issue that I might have decided differently had I thought about this particular fact pattern at the time. And it is an issue that I believe, based on the way you've articulated your recommendation here, that we can solve in a very narrow, very specific way. But I think that does depend on the way that we approach this. And I think it is important that we leave the wording that is in the standard right now, that's B411B, I think, as untouched as we possibly can, including terms like the consideration paid and et cetera, because I think that's what a lot of people have already thought about, have already gone through a lot of process. It means that we then create this as an exception on top of that, that is very limited exception, that's very specific, and I think that exception wording is also very important. We're not trying to influence the way people previously read B411 or imply that they were reading it too narrowly. We're making it very clear that it's an exception on top of that, and I think that keeps the process narrow. The only additional point I'd make is that I am still ever so slightly concerned about the adoption date. What we are implying here is a mandatory change. If I have these instruments, I will previously have concluded something else applying B411. I'm now going to change my conclusion point. I think that's what you're raising too. And so I think at the very least we should be asking the question in the exposure draft whether people think that there are consequences that may lead to them struggling to adopt the standard, and or consider whether or not it should be a mandatory date of a little bit later to give people who might have a problem with allowing early adoption at the same time as they adopt IFRS 9. So is there anything I would...
Absolutely fair point, Daryl. I think the last suggestion, we will certainly go ahead if the board approves it. I think also one of the reasons is that if I look at the symmetric under 39, there would be embeddeds that would be split, so they would have the data, but certainly we will frame it, if you think, because that's, there is also the fair value option that some people might have used for these.
I think we mustn't forget, though, that we have constrained the fair value option. It's not just a pure, do I want to?
Amaru.
Thanks, Hans. Now, in short, I do agree with staff's proposal, but I would like to make some comments. I would assert that most of them were aligned with what Sue and Daryl mentioned. I my vision on this is similar to Sue. We, in practice, we are actually extending what we do have. I agree with Kumar that it's difficult to anticipate what would the board have decided if this had been brought at this level of detail at the time. Myself would personally agree with this very same treatment, because I think, as we state in paragraph 14, and this is one of the key aspects, is how to encapsulate this limited number of contracts in this additional condition, is that they really these contracts, I think the effective interest method does provide the information needed by users. And I'm, my guess is that most entities that are preparing to adopt IFRS 9 are considering these to be under amortized cost. So in this sense, Tak, I think if we do not go ahead with something like this extension would cause significant disturbance in terms of systems and how the information needed to be gathered in terms of providing fair value would be a significant change in their practice today. And I also agree, I think it's my read of the staff's proposal is that what is very important is in paragraph 14, 22, and 23, they would be included in the reasoning of this proposal. I must, because of my language, I must stress the point of the time for consultation. I understand the time frame of the project and the 30 days that it's not under discussion right now. The staff is going to discuss with the POC, but I just must mention that consider other language and maybe, if possible, extend at least a little bit the time for consultation for them to have the time to translate and go ahead with the consultation.
I understand that, Amara. If I could just react to that, and I know it's not the topic, but it's probably worth just flagging, because based on what I've seen of the sort of timeline we've been working towards, even if we do 30 days, we're pushing it to get it done by the 1st of January 2018, and I think that the challenge would be that if we don't make this change, we could end up in a situation where we make people measure something at fair value through profit or loss that we then intend them ultimately to be allowed to do amortized cost accounting for, and that's not going to be without cost for those people.
Yeah, no, I'm not saying to compromise our expected date for publication in October, and I do agree we should finish and publish the final amendment in time to give people who are going to apply IFRS 9 the time to consider this, but I'm just this is something that I must mention.
Fully appreciate it, Amaru. You see, with the timeline, you will have a full discussion. Let's go out, because the way we phrase it with the DPOC is not less than. So the board does have that if they approve, assuming me. The problem is if I do extend it, if you look at the period that we have put May comment ends, and I'm going to bring June, July comment letter analysis, I'm glad Sue didn't already beat me up on saying that, are you kidding yourself?
I'm
rightly
fully aware of that.
And we will have two meetings. We can't bring comment letter analysis and technical decisions in the same meeting. It doesn't work. We'll have to do that. So it will be difficult, let me put it. We'll certainly bring it back, but I would like to put this down is that I think overall, given what Sue also said and given what we heard, meeting that October deadline before 18 is critical, so we might have to do a shorter comment period for that to see. And what that's what history, given our past history, will be difficult. But I appreciate where you're coming from. We do have translation. We'll try and see if we can work through some of our translation teams to give the people heads up so that they are focused on it a little bit earlier.
But hopefully in this case, the preparers will not ask us for a very comprehensive testing phase or something like that.
I don't think so.
Mary?
several thoughts and comments that, again, may be more for basis of conclusions rather than trying to shift or block the project. But I think I characterize myself as begrudging acceptance rather than support for it. And I think I'd want to reinforce a couple of Daryl's points about the importance of this being clearly identified as a change and as the creation of an exception if we do go forward. I think another important part of the message is we will only proceed with this if we can do it for a narrow targeted change. And that's kind of to Gary's point about as soon as you open it up, does it immediately mushroom into re-deliberations? Because it is, to my mind, worth doing on an accelerated basis only if we can get it done. And I think looking at your timeline, appreciating that's not really part of today's discussion, it's going to be crucial that we reach a conclusion in, I think, June about whether we are proceeding or saying this can't happen. Yeah, you know, it isn't that we commit to a specific thing, but that we have enough feedback to say this will work and is worth trying to finalize, or that we must abandon and this is what you have to live with, you know, in terms of the implementation. Now, some of the things that make me that create the willingness first is that the interpretation committee looked at this, and I think it's the interpretation committee coming and recommending that we look at this, and what I recall from December's discussion is that we try to do something in time for the first time implementation of this standard that makes me want to try and respond, because that's a good balance in that group in terms of what they're saying to us about what's important. The thing, though, that makes me reluctant, and this is what I want to think about, it kind of goes back to some of Gary's and Talk's concerns. I think if we, this paper is rightly very focused on SPPI and is it consistent with earlier conclusions about SPPI. I think if we step back and look and say, the question is also about, should be about the usefulness, the relevance, and the faithful representation of amortized cost accounting for these instruments. The more that the prepayments, as Gary said, can trigger negative compensation, start raising questions for me at least about the balance sheet, whether it's a faithful representation, because you're now recognizing something that you may not recover, even though your business model is held to collect, for a reason other than credit. And it's increasing kind of the exposure to changes in market rates. And so that raises questions about the relevance of that amortized cost accounting. Now, I think that the counterpart, what I've inferred from these papers and some of the other comments, is that people still think there's a high degree of relevance from the P&L presentation of amortized cost. And so maybe that's the counterbalance. But I want to flag this isn't a how wide can you make it, because I think it does strain the usefulness of at least the balance sheet measurement. So, a concern of mine. And the other thing that I struggle with a bit is, is that as we shift the payments from the contractual rate to something that's based on current rates, you know, I think we've heard that amortized cost remains relevant as the P&L measure, and I kind of begin to question why a bit. So when I come, when I come back to what the constraint is, I think you've highlighted in here in the paper why we have concerns about the fair value option, you know, the prepayment at fair value. And I do have questions conceptually about why we're using the fair value at initial recognition as the test, you know, the how wide does the gate open test, because fair value is one of the attributes that we've concluded is not relevant for things that are measured at amortized cost. But I guess I get it. I get why you come back to saying that's the only thing we can find that is operational, simple, and effective. I like Sue's points about what we also emphasized before we get to that consideration. And what I want to ask the staff to think about as you look about drafting this, if we do decide to go ahead, you know, for the ED, is whether we try and relate constraints to the amortized cost measurement, because I think I could argue that some of the other things that people have brought up as things for which I, as the lender, deserve to be compensated, let's say if I've entered into hedging arrangements of some kind and the cost of breaking those hedging arrangements, I could argue that qualitatively they are compensation for costs that I have, but to me there should not fit in under the magic words in the standard about compensation, because they're compensation for an attribute that I've concluded is not relevant to the measurement of these items. And so I think if we can explain that a bit more qualitatively, we have to rationalize why we're using a fair value measurement as the gatekeeper, but it will also help us define a narrow band of what is considered compensation, rather than a lot of things that people could argue are, from the bank's business model, compensation, what they suffer. And I think it's because they're not relevant to amortized cost measurement.
No, fair enough, Mary. I think that's a fair point, and it brings back to what I think Sue was also saying, and yeah, that Sue's point is that it's compensation for the asset that was in SVPI as per our definition, not based on what you are doing with the hedging and everything. We will certainly do that. That's what we tried to do in paragraph 22. And I think the fair value measure, and we also tested with some of the people, is that because what we tried to do is because I think that's a neat way of encapsulating where that the probability of these will be low, because that's one of the key drivers of fair value. So the deviation from what you rightly pointed out is why amortized cost, and it's a stable profile, we expect it to be less, not that frequent.
But that frequency point also may be worth bringing up, because frankly, if you have a portfolio of instruments on which you expect a relatively high level of prepayments, then I think you have to not focus narrowly on does this meet the definition of, look, I have an exception for prepayments, but stand back and say, how does something that has a high level of prepayments meet the overall objective of hold to collect?
But the problem is hold to collect is hold to collect the contractual cash flows.
But I think the fair value for that level encapsulates that quite tightly, because what I would argue is that if you start having a very high level of prepayments all through, your assertion that fair value at initial recognition is insignificant is questionable.
Martin.
Well, I agree with the staff recommendation to expose this as an exception. And my main reason is because I really think this kind of instruments are really belonging in banking business more to the banking book. And Tuck asked the question, what is wrong with to measure that at fair value? And I think this is, in my understanding, kind of a plain vanilla loan business with this feature. And based on my experience, okay, the most important performance measure for this kind of business is net interest margin. And I think if we don't allow amortized cost, okay, we will not include it in net interest margin. We have to fair value that, and that I think really is a kind of, for me, convincing, okay, that is we should allow that exception. And really, I agree with all this kind of, we should not allow that if it is kind of very, very frequent and has a high value. And therefore, I'm happy with this condition which you have put into, is the fair value at inception should be low. And that is the reason why I more or less, I think we should do that, because I think it is a better information and amortized cost for the performance than we have if we would have done fair value for this kind of instruments. And if it is a kind of frequent with high value, I think we will not allow it, and that it's fair value and it's a different feature.
Gary. Having listened to the discussion for the last 45 minutes, I haven't changed my initial view. Sometimes I do, but actually, I'm assuming we go forward with this. Characterizing this as an exception, I think, and maybe that's at the end is the only way we can characterize it. I would challenge the staff, we don't have to process it today. Can you find logic in addition to it's an exception? You know, whether it's, you know, compensation always could have been plus or minus, whatever fits in principle or whatever. Because when you start calling something an exception, why is this guy's exception any better than anybody else's request for an exception? You're going back to containing the scope. And I don't know how you'd answer that other than, like, I gave them an exception, I'm not going to give you an exception, when in their mind the argument might be of equal weight and relative same importance. When you have no one would ever mistake me for a fair value of all things all the time type guy, but here in case when either side can put or call the instrument at any point in time for an amount that could be higher or lower than the uncollected balance, it's still feels like a fair value situation, more so to me. And I'll just leave it at that.
We'll try and justify it.
Doc. Thank you. My fellow board members, the opinion really persuading me to know the importance of this project, but not 100% yet. So just one question to Darrell and one question to Martin. And the question to Darrell, I understand that it's symmetrical, so then we allow unexpected income, then why not unexpected losses? As a mechanism, I understand that. However, in the case of unexpected losses, from the viewpoint of prudence or viewpoint of conservativeness, then normally we do not, there are lots of cases of asymmetric treatment. So in this sense, the current exception B 4.11 makes sense. On this point, how do you think about it? And the question to Martin is, I do understand it depicts net interest margin better by using amortized cost. However, there are many other plain vanilla style instrument with small proportion of kind of derivative to make loan attractive. So for those instruments, we say it's not SPPI. Mm. And then why only this? That's the question we need to answer, as Gary pointed out. So for these two, if I make clear these two points, I would be happy to agree with the staff's recommendation.
So I think for me, the issue is that what we're discussing here at the outset is, I think, characterization of an instrument. What is the character of this particular instrument? And to my mind, the fact that the cash flow might be a little bit positive or a little bit negative is not changing the character of the instrument.
Mm.
So it remains the same. Classification is about identifying the character. And so if I think about this two sides of the coin, it might be an unexpected profit, it might be an unexpected loss.
Yeah.
Does the fact that in one circumstance it's an unexpected loss change my view on the characterization of the instrument? I think it's actually the same instrument, whether it's... So that's where I get to. Yeah. Now, I do agree that does potentially create a measurement issue, which is the measurement, as you would call, as you refer to, the prudence issue.
Yeah.
The prudence issue for me, though, comes in, well, the measurement perspective comes in from saying that when you estimate your EIR for these types of contracts, you have to give consideration to what you think the outcome is going to be.
Yeah.
And if events come to mind that would suggest to you that that has changed, I think you would change the EIR to reflect that. So I think there is already an element that's built into that.
In the current.
You're talking about the catch-up.
The catch-up.
No,
sorry.
Tack, I think your question's a fair one, because you're right that the fact that it's normal isn't enough for us usually to say, because it's normal to you, will allow you to use amortized cost. We've been very particular about when we think it's okay. And so I think your question is a fair one. And I think that the point that you make about losses is, even though I'm usually the biggest proponent of symmetry everywhere else, so I feel a little bit hypocritical as I say it, but you're right that if we do this, we will have more circumstances where you could be booking a particular interest rate and then you could have a loss because of this. So I think it does have a sort of change, and it comes back to Mary's point about would you recover the carrying amount, that balance sheet focus. But I think for me the reason why it's worth exposing and considering this exception is because it is so pervasive. So usually if you say to me, basically at overall it looks like a normal instrument except it's got this one little feature, do I say, oh well, that's okay, then I'll let you have that.
Okay.
We don't usually allow that, do we? Because if you have one small feature, there's no sort of significance test, if you like, in solely payments of principal and interest. It just says if there's circumstances where that has more than a de minimis effect, strike out, they're not an amortized cost. But here I think because it's so pervasive, it could start to have a really big effect on things like NIM, to Martin's point, and maybe that's, it's a pervasiveness, I think, that might be what's really factoring into this. But I think that's why it needs to be an exception in my mind, and I hear Gary's reservations, but because otherwise people are going to say, well, if it's ish okay, then the board seems to think it's all right. But I don't think we are saying that. I think we're saying in this very particular situation, we'll make an exception to our normal thinking.
Plus, we say the fair value should be zero or close to zero at the start.
And
as a result of there being reasonable additional compensation being in place, which should mean that it will remain exceptional in case of divorces or whatever reasons to why you want to repay a mortgage, but not because you want to play the market.
And I think what you asked, because we don't have concluded that if there is any embedded derivative in this feature that will not, I think, fulfill the SPBI test, because we have in B4111B, we have already said that it's this kind of embedded, which is embedded derivative because there is a prepayment feature, will meet the SPBI conditions. So we have made already.
But we're always very clear which ones we think
but
are okay.
But there is a little bit extension now to that, and that is the reason why I think it is different.
And that is why we are targeting it as an exception. We do not deny it's expanding, but that's why we want to keep what we are doing as narrow as possible.
See, we are fully convinced. That leaves Amaro.
just one additional aspect that's important and aligned with the point that you made. In many jurisdictions, those clauses are included because of they are required by law. But in practice, they are almost never exercised. And the fair value that Hans mentioned will be almost always similar to the amortized cost because of the lack of a securitized market or a secondary market for these loans. So if we don't do that, we are actually imposing for banking businesses type and information that is actually valued by users as being representative of the expected cash flows, a significant burden in terms of operationality.
So, shall we go through the questions?
One by one.
We would like to ask three questions, and we would request the board to vote on board on each question separately. So the first question is, does the board agree with the staff recommendation to propose a narrow exception to IFRS 9 so that a prepayable financial asset would be eligible to be measured at amortized cost or fair value through OCI subject to business model condition if A, the financial asset would otherwise meet the requirements in paragraph B4111B, but does not do so only as a result of the symmetric nature of the prepayment option, and B, when the entity initially recognized the financial asset, the fair value of the symmetric prepayment feature is insignificant.
Those. Okay. Let's do accounting.
1, 2, 3, 11.
11 in favor. The next question, stop and give it to me. Go on.
The second question, does the board agree with that the proposed effective date for the exception should be the same as the effective date of IFRS 9, that is annual periods beginning on or after 1st January 2018?
With a slight modification here and incorporating Daryl's suggestion that you said we ask the question and look at whether this will cause problems, that is what we are modifying the thing.
Excellent.
Yeah.
All in favour?
Last question. Does the board agree that the proposed exception should be applied retrospectively, subject to the transition provision described in paragraph 29 and disclosure requirements in paragraph 30?
On this point, just one question.
Doug's favourite subject.
Yeah, my favourite subject. So I want to make sure that, you know, it's fine, probably. Because, you know, the according to your outreach data, it wouldn't cause any significant problem. But in theory, I disagree with this kind of proposal. Having said that, on this particular issue, believing your outreach, I agree with.
But in theory, I really
don't like this because there are many constituents who has already applied. Then those who has to go back and check, and it is not really fair. So therefore, we try best to avoid such kind of situation. But in this particular case, hearing from the urgency of this, I agree with the proposal.
But we will also find out in the when we expose that.
An observation about how we have phrased the transition. If you look at paragraph 29, at the end of it, saying you assess SPPI without taking into account the proposed exception. And just without taking into account, I think that is relating to the fact that we want to characterize this, you know, that we believe that this is an exception, and that's why we're saying don't take it into account. But I think we have to be very careful about how we write this, because we are saying consider this option when you are estimating the cash flows and how often the prepayment terms will be exercised. When, you know, if you decide it qualifies for
the exception,
if you decide that an instrument meets the SPPI requirements with this exception, then you still have to consider that term when you are doing the accounting, including in the estimates of cash flows. So it's not saying do not account for this, it's saying only in connection with SPPI.
It could probably be drafted to say that when you, when you're assessing the classification of your instrument, when you don't read those
only for the purpose of assessing the classification. It's not wrong, but I think we have to be very clear.
We've written this before, there's precedent, so be careful.
Okay,
can we get the vote?
All in favour.
Okay.
All right, very good.
Thank you.
We are a little bit ahead.